Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Is my creation! Life!
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let's go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Get countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey there. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon here on the Guy James Show. See if I can get those music guys to stop. They're a little enthusiastic today. Welcome. Coming to you from the blue waters and sandy beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida, Naples, Fort Myers area, and all points in between there and maybe a little bit east and west out into the Gulf. If you're out into the Gulf fishing this afternoon, why, join in. I don't know how many guys listen to the radio while they're fishing. I really don't. But anyway, there's some of them out there. Interesting today, what we're going to do, our first hour is going to go along as usual. We're going to have a good guest with us. We have Representative Allison Schwartz from the 13th District of Pennsylvania over Philadelphia way, and we're going to talk about health care. We're going to talk about health care quite a bit the first hour today. And then the second hour, due to the fact that there's construction going on next door, and they tell me there's going to be loud construction starting at 4 o'clock. They were nice enough to warn me. Too loud, in fact. They're going to be using hammer drills on a cement building, and the noise, I'm afraid, will resonate throughout this building, and it'll be too loud for us to use our microphones. So we're going to have a talk by Jonathan Alter, an audio by Jonathan Alter, talking about his terrific book, Frank and Roosevelt, The Defining Moment, and it is a terrific book. So we'll have that on for you in the second hour. In the first hour, we'll talk a lot about health care. Health care, I want to know, how many of you have any hope for a meaningful health care bill? I want you to know right now, I don't. I think there is, the chances are slim and none of coming up with a good health care bill. I just don't think it's going to happen. And I think all of our politicians have been bought off. Not all of them, but a goodly number of them are bought off. And we're not going to see it happen. Just not going to happen this time around. Maybe never. And I would like to let you know also, I've got a million things going on here in the studio. Got about four computers running and a little something going on in every one of them. Keep in mind from this. This scare tactic has been going on for how long from the Republicans? Folks over at Think Progress today reminded me that tomorrow is the 44th anniversary of Medicare. 44th. and it is an essential government-sponsored health care program that provides coverage to virtually all of the nation's elderly and a large share of people with disabilities. And I don't think I have to tell you that Medicare has been a resounding success. There's no other way you can say it, a resounding success. And again from Think Progress, it says, at the time of its creation, of course, I added the of course, conservatives strongly opposed Medicare, warning that a government-run program would lead to socialism in America. And who was out there leading the charge on that? None other than St. Ronnie of Reagan. Yes, socialism in America. And his own words, if you don't stop Medicare and I don't do it, one of these days, you and I are going to spend our sunset years, well, Ronnie has already spent his sunset years, telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free. Now, can't you see Ronnie, St. Ronnie of Reagan, having Michael and Ron Jr. before he went on to his reward, whatever it may be, telling them, yes, this is what it was like back when we were still free, before that Medicare came along and ruined these United States. George H.W. Bush described Medicare in 1964 as socialized medicine. Get that word in there, socialized. Barry Goldwater, having given our pensioners their medical care in kind, why not food baskets? Why not public housing accommodations? Why not vacation resorts? Why not a ration of cigarettes for those who smoke and of beer for those who drink? Barry Goldwater. And Bob Dole. What a group of intelligent men we've got here. Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Barry Goldwater, and Bob Dole. Goldwater probably the smartest of the bunch, but was not above using scare tactics. Bob Dole said, 1996. Now, mind you, this is after Medicare has been in business for, what, 31 years? While running for the presidency, Dole openly bragged that he was one of 12 House members who voted against creating Medicare in 1965. He said, I was there, fighting the fight, voting against Medicare, because I knew it wouldn't work back in 1965. He knew it wouldn't work. Bob Dole's an idiot. George H.W. Bush is an idiot. Ronald Reagan was an idiot. Sorry, folks. Sorry for those of you that want marble statues of Ronald Reagan put on every street corner. I'm sorry to all of you who want every school in the nation, every college, every federal building named for Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was a political idiot. Ronald Reagan was a Class B actor. Ronald Reagan was a guy who was a good communicator, I will give you that. But he was an actor, you see. An actor. A guy that read some lines and then mimicked them. Then, you know, I don't know what the big deal is about acting. Acting is, well, I'll just say it. I've done a lot of it in little theater. It's easy. You just have to go and pretend like you are somebody else or that you know something that you don't actually know. You use other people's words, other people's deeds, other people's actions. But Ronald Reagan was a political, well. And so here we have the Republicans recycling the same fear-mongering rhetoric today in an effort to defeat the public option. And I know some of you are aware of Igor Volsky. He notes on the Wonk Room, conservatives have attempted in the decades since Medicare's creation to kill it and force it to wither on the vine. And while Medicare is not without its problems, and I would caution everybody to say that no program is perfect, it has dramatically improved access to health care, and it has allowed seniors to live longer, allowed them to live healthier, and it's helped greatly reduce poverty amongst the elderly. And it's contributed to the desegregation of southern hospitals and has become one of the most popular government programs. You would find very few people that would voice serious opposition to Medicare these days. Even this afternoon on MSNBC, Representative Mike Pence, and damn it, I'm getting tired of seeing his face on TV. He's explained his opposition to a new public health care option by arguing that Medicare spending has exceeded actuarial estimates from 1965. And as Andrea Mitchell pointed out somewhat jokingly, she said, I don't know if you want to go back to Indiana and campaign against Medicare. Oh, no, I support Medicare, Pence responded. So the fools are out in force, and they're going to beat this health care thing to death. And they will fear-monger it as much as they possibly can. And you're going to hear more crap in the next month or two or however long to get anything done, long it takes to get anything done on the Medicare or on the health care issue. I want to tell you right here and now, and I'll stake my reputation on this, you will not see a health care benefit bill pass that's worth squat. Maybe for a tiny minority of the people, you'll see something pass. That I'll guarantee you. What it's worth, it won't be worth a bucket of spit. I promise you that. We're going to have the best health care bill a lobbyist can buy. And I would remind everybody of this. Another 14,000 Americans lost their health insurance today. How many members of Congress do you suppose lost their health care today? I think you know the answer to that. And averaging out what Senator Max Baucus takes from the health care industry when they stuff his pockets full of campaign money, he made another $1,500 in bribes from the health care industry today. So once again, the score is fat cats, quite a lot. You and me, zip. You know, news that Senator Max Baucus' Finance Committee deal on health care financing excluded a public option. Get this. The word is out that the Finance Committee has left out a public option, which that fact in and of itself declares this whole thing null and void as far as I'm concerned. Left out the public option, and what happened? The insurance, the health insurance stocks went wild today. That's right. Shares of U.S. health insurers rose broadly on Tuesday on hopes a health reform bill would not include a government-run option. The S&P Managed Healthcare Index of large U.S. health insurers closed 6.5% higher yesterday. Aetna rose 12.6% in one day, mind you. Not bad, huh? Wonder if Max has any stock in Aetna. Coventry was up 12.7%. Cigna, 7.7 to the good. All of them on the New York Stock Exchange. Centene rose 7.9%. The health insurance executives who have literally poured money into the campaign coffers of Blue Dogs, Max Baucus, Chuck Grassley, Kent Conrad, Joe Lieberman, and Susan Collins, along with their political action committees, the people that spent the money on these guys likely made every dime of it back in one day because of the rise of stock prices. That is what this all is all about. They spent millions and millions of dollars fighting a public option in this health care bill, and they got it all back yesterday. All of it. Not a bad investment, do you think? You don't have to wonder whether Wall Street thinks Max Baucus' deal is great news for the health insurance industry status quo, because numbers like these that I just mentioned don't lie. Let's be perfectly clear here, and I don't care what politician knows it, and I will mention it today to our guest. Let's be absolutely clear how we feel about it, how I feel about it anyway. That health care bill coming out of the Max Baucus Committee will be the best bipartisan bill that lobbyist money bought. Hopefully the rest of America's interest can be reconciled with it once Baucus and his five greedy friends get their hands off of it. But never mind that. It's not going to happen. They're starting to pass the word. I heard Laura Ingraham. I've heard others now say that Democrats are going to start finding ways to kill old people, so that we don't have to pay their health care bills. Maybe they're suggesting that we're going to round them up in railroad cars and ship them off to the deserts of Arizona and New Mexico in some sort of concentration camp. Maybe it would be like that movie Soylent Green. People just come up missing. When you're old and you start needing medical care, the Democrats are going to come for you in the middle of the night and haul you away, so that they can save on health care bills. That's what they're going to do. The Democrats are going to kill you, old folks. They're going to neglect you. They're going to take your Medicare away. They're going to take everything away from you. Oh, and they'll tax you while they're doing it. You get a cup of gruel every day until you can no longer function, and then, you know, there are those ovens waiting. That's what they would have you believe. They're starting to advertise that now. They're starting to play on the fears of the elderly in this country and tell them that the Democrats are going to put you down the hospice chute. Look, a single-payer plan is only politically possible if you and I demand it. We can stand out here and shuffle our feet and say, oh, well, just pass something. But that's what's got us in all these messes in the first place. And if all that talk of change meant anything, if it meant anything at all, it should mean that we stop doing that. That we stop standing by idly and letting these politicians get away with this kind of deception and downright thievery. Don't get on the bandwagon to pass any more stupid bills. They're trying to sucker every man, woman, every voter in America into going along with, well, we'll do these co-ops, you know. Kent Conrad has come up with this genius plan of these co-ops, many of which have failed already. Co-op type insurers have failed already. This administration campaigned on change, and by God, there had better be some change. And on this bill, this is it. This is it. We've had Harry Reid for several years saying we've got to pick our battles. Well, Harry, this is the battle. This is the Armageddon. This is where you take a stand and do not fall back, not one inch. If there was ever a time in recent American political history, this is the time to put all the chips on the table, everything in, call their bluff, and go for it. Any shrinking violet in the Democratic Party who doesn't have the balls to go all out in this fight is no Democrat to me, is somebody that I would never, ever back again. I don't care who it is. If our president does not go balls to the wall on this, I will be sorely disappointed in him. If the Democrats don't pass this bill, come hell or high water, you know, I've always advertised this show as America's Democratic Liberal Radio Show. I will take the name Democratic off of it because I will be ashamed. Because we have the opportunity to pass these bills. We have the opportunity to use the rules to our advantage to override anything that the Republicans can do. We should use the nuclear option on the Republicans on a filibuster if they try and beat us on this. Whatever means are necessary should be used to pass this. And I want to tell you right now, President Obama and the Democratic leadership, if you don't rise up in righteous indignation against these Republicans on this health care bill and get something significant done for the American people, you are going to lose all of your political capital, and rightly so. Then we begin the search for somebody who does have the balls to come out and fight for what is right instead of play politics with the health of the American people. You know, I found an old quote today that it would be wise for the Obama administration to remember. And the quote is this: "The palace is not safe when the cottage is not happy." It's a quotation from Benjamin Disraeli. And perhaps those people that live in the palace should take heed of that. Because as sure as I'm sitting here, and the email I got and the conversations I have with people, and what I hear from you, that if they don't do something meaningful, not just another one of these bills that yada, 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 don't want to see that. I want to see health care for all Americans. I want to see a public option. I want to see the insurance companies have some competition. They must fight to the political death on this issue. So, Harry Reid, what kind of guts do you have? I think a lot of you know that I'm not very optimistic about that. Nancy Pelosi, what kind of guts do you have? Both of them, and Obama, should be on television all day and all night, every day, lambasting anybody that tries to strike fear in the hearts of the elderly over this health care bill. They should stick it to them 24/7. Run one representative out after another, after another, after another. Political fortunes be damned. As I told one of the congressmen that was on our show not too long ago, wouldn't it be something if every time somebody went to take a vote, that they voted for what was right instead of what meant something politically to them? Wouldn't that be something? Can you imagine every one of our elected representatives going in to cast his vote on every vote, and nothing more is in his mind than what's right for the American people? Not how should I vote so I can get more campaign contributions? Not how should I vote so I can get reelected and keep my job and keep my health care? But rather go in and pull the lever every time on your vote, having in your mind, I'm doing the right thing for the American people, for all of them, for the greater good. My God, I would pass out if I knew that all the elected representatives, it gives me goosebumps thinking about them walking in, you know, a Mr. Smith going to Washington type deal, and standing up and standing for what's right and voting for what's right instead of what's best for them for their reelection. We're going to have Congresswoman Allison Schwartz on the show in just a few minutes. We'll ask her some tough questions. I'm just tired of hearing from all the politicians that we're starting to hear. Now, they're starting to backpedal. A lot of the Democrats are starting to backpedal. Well, you know, it's an art of compromise, and we have to compromise with the Republicans. You don't have to compromise with the Republicans on this. You don't have to compromise with the Republicans on one damn thing right now. We have that much of a majority in the House. We have a foolproof majority in the Senate. And we can override any filibuster with a nuclear option. It's just whether or not anybody's got the balls to do it. We don't have to compromise. I understand that politics is the art of compromise, but there comes a time when you do not compromise anymore. There comes a time when you take a stand, you hold that stand, you hold that ground, and you don't give it up. And if you move an inch, you've lost. And now is that time. We are neglecting people in Afghanistan and Iraq, troops right now, over this issue, because this issue is at the forefront of everything in America now. Let's get this done. Let's do it right. Let's do what needs to be done and forget this fear-mongering like I just read you from that idiot Reagan and George H.W. Bush and Barry Goldwater and Bob Dole. Oh, we'll be telling our grandchildren and our children and grandchildren what it used to be like when America was free. That's their king, Ronald Reagan, saying that 40 years ago. I'll bet he didn't tell his children before he died that America, what America used to be like because of the failure of Medicare, because he didn't know what the hell he was talking about. That's why. He tried the fear-mongering then, and he was stupid. There's no other way to put it. He was stupid. What happened with Medicare is an unparalleled success. I will trust my fortunes to the government running a public health option. I most certainly will. And I'll bet you a dollar to a donut most everybody that's uninsured would as well. So don't fall for it. Fight it tooth and nail. Every time you hear it, every time you hear it from one of your friends' mouth, I don't care if you're sitting in a restaurant, I don't care if you're sitting someone having a beer, when someone brings up this idiocy of, oh, we'll all lose our health insurance if the Democrats have their way, tell them. Stop it right there. They look at you with eyes wide open and say, whoa. Tell them the truth. Tell them what Limbaugh's been telling them. Tell them what Laura Ingraham's been telling them, and Sean Hannity's been telling them, and Newt Gingrich has been telling them. Tell them Mark Levin and all those freaking idiots. Tell them they're full of crap. and tell them how it really is, because I know you know how it really is. I know you know what it is that should be in the public health care bill. Don't let it stand. I'll tell you what, I don't. I've challenged people, plenty of them lately, and they don't like it. But they're going to hear the truth. They can, well, I won't go there, but I won't stand for hearing it anymore. I don't care where I'm at. I don't care who I'm with. If I hear anybody telling these lies and these falsities about what it is we want in this health care program, I'm going to stop them right then and there and set them straight. And we all need to do that every single time. I've said my piece. How do you feel about it? I won't take any calls just right now because we are waiting on a call from Representative Allison Schwartz from the 13th District of Pennsylvania, including parts of Philadelphia. If you have a question that you would like put to her, please send me an email, guyjames@theguyjamesshow.com, and we'll try and get your questions in. I don't apologize for going on about this issue. It's something near and dear to my heart. I pick up the local newspaper and I read all the people in here that, oh, it's socialized medicine. I'm thinking, you know, you freaking idiot. I would love to talk to you face to face. The newspaper allows letters to the editor to be put in that are obscenely idiotic. But people that you read their letters and you understand that they don't know squat. We had a letter in our paper last night. This is a big newspaper. It's not the New York Times, but it's a big newspaper. Had a letter in there last night about all these illegal aliens getting Medicare and Social Security. That's bullshit. They don't get Social Security and Medicare. They don't get it. And yet, millions of people believe that that's the case. Millions of people believe that because of your Rush Limbaughs and your Hannitys and your Bill O'Reillys and your Glenn Becks and the rest of those idiots. So it's your job and it's my job to make it right every time you hear it. I don't care. I don't care whether it's a relative. I don't care if it's your best friend. Like I said, I don't care if you're standing in line at the Dairy Queen. If you hear somebody say that, turn around and get in their face. You don't have to be mean about it. Say, no, let me tell you, I heard what you said. Let me tell you the truth of the matter. Let me tell you that Medicare is an overwhelming success. Let me ask you if your parents are on Medicare and have done okay with it. Let me ask you if you want to give up your Medicare benefits. Huh? Let me ask you if you want to give up your Social Security check. Let me ask you, Mr. Veteran, do you want to give up your VA benefits? The answer is no, hell no, from every one of them. They need to be reminded. We need to kickstart that little argument once in a while. Like I said, you don't have to be mean about it, but you need to be stern about it. You need to be firm about it. And if they threaten to kick your ass, oh well. It's been kicked for a good reason. Oh my. I'm in a mood today. Our guest is a little late in calling today. They probably got a vote going on in the House. I should turn on the TV here in the studio and find out what's happening. I think what we're going to do, if you don't mind, what will we do, if you don't mind? I'm going to take a quick break, and we'll come back in just a minute. If our guest calls in the meantime, we will break in, okay?
Baby, when I met you, there was peace. I set out to get you with a fine suit gown. I was shocked inside. There was something going on. You do something to me that I can't explain. Pull me closer and I feel no pain. Every beat of my heart, we got something going on.
Hello, you're listening to The Guy James Show.
Yes, good afternoon. This is Carlton from Congresswoman Allison Schwartz's office.
Yes.
I just wanted to let you know that the Congresswoman is actually on the floor voting right now and is running a few minutes late. So as soon as she's done these votes in the next 5 minutes, she'll be calling in.
Okay, that'll be great. And when she calls in, we'll go live immediately, all right?
Very good. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling. Thanks for letting us know.
No problem. Bye now.
Bye now. Well, there you have it. See, that's how it goes. I figured she was on the floor doing a vote or two. Wonder what they're voting on right now. We'll ask her when she comes on. She will call. She's the most engaging lady. We've had her on the program before. You know, one of those Philly cheesesteak sandwiches sounds pretty good right now. Yeah. Little onion. Mm-hmm. That does sound good. I'll see if she can ship us a few of those. Hey, thanks for joining us here on the Guy James Show today. I do want to let you know we are going to do something a little different today. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to have some noise around here coming up at 4 o'clock. So starting right then, right after the news, we're going to have a talk by Jonathan Alter about his book about Franklin Roosevelt, which I must tell you is a masterpiece. It is a masterpiece. And I think you'll enjoy hearing from him, if that all goes well, technically, anyway. I thought this was a hoot. I thought this was a real hoot. I got to tell you, I'm originally from Ohio, and I've always had respect for George Voinovich. He is a Republican, and he was the mayor of Cleveland, and... but I got a cold drink being brought into the studio by the executive producer. Oh, man. Yes. Now, don't get excited. It's not booze. It's water with ice cubes. But the executive producer could tell I was getting a little dry, and the executive producer has the official Guy James Show Yorkies following her around. Is my wife Bess, by the way, is the executive producer, and Kukla and Sophie are right behind. Oh, yes. You know, it's amazing, little dogs like that. I was gone for a while, and then she was gone for a while, and those little dogs, they miss their mommy or daddy when they're not around, and when they come home, they're just like, oh, boy, hello. You know how it is, you folks that have puppies. Anyway... they're looking good today, all three of them. Yeah, my wife just got in from Northwest Ohio last night, and I've mentioned to you before that she's like purebred Greek, okay? And she lived in Greece for a while, and she speaks the language fluently, and so they had their Grecian festival where she was over the last week or so, and it's a big, huge festival in Northeast Ohio, and she brought home a shirt, says, I went, I ate, and, or what was it, Come here and tell us. You got to come here and tell us what it said. Now you got to speak up here. What does this shirt say?
I came, I saw, I ate.
And just exactly what did you eat? What kind of Greek food did you have? You didn't have any calamari.
No, I had smelts.
Smelts.
Everybody loves smelts.
There was
a long line all the way around the.
For smelts.
Pastizo.
Yeah.
Moussaka. Stuffed tomatoes.
Ah, yes.
And Greek donuts.
How about the one that's my favorite, the tzatziki?
Tzatziki with the souvlaki.
So the souvlaki and the cheese that's on fire. What do they call that? You know when they take that cheese and they light it up? Oh, it's good. Now, did you have any ouzo?
No, I had beer.
Now, how do you go to a Greek festival? Oh, they're asking on the, do you have any leftovers, Bess?
No, I ate it all.
But you did ship something home, right? You bought some things you're shipping home.
Yes.
You had shipped home.
Yes.
So there'll be a care package arriving at today. So I want to thank our executive producer for dropping in on the show.
You're quite welcome.
All right.
Yasu.
Yasu, she said. All right.
Opa.
We went to a Yanni concert one time.
Yep.
We did. And I had to get into it. I yelled, Opa, all night long. Or, Yasu, Yanni. I guess Yanni's still out there doing it. Hey, Bess, what is a Greek donut? They're asking me, what is a Greek donut? She's coming back down the hall to the studio. She got to explain. See, now I got to tell you what I'll tell you what a Greek donut is, but she'll tell you first.
It's a deep fried dough, and then you put honey on the donut and cinnamon, and they're delicious.
Okay, all right. Well, there you go. Honey, deep fried dough, put honey on it, and then cinnamon, and they're delicious. Yeah, there's usually I've been to that festival, and there's usually a big long line at that outfit as well. So everybody's going yum. Now that you've ruined everybody on the chat room, they're all going yum. And one of them says, fried smelts. I don't know about the fried smelts.
Oh, yeah, it's big.
They like moussaka, too.
Yeah.
Moussaka. Lotter J says, I make them all the time. But it says they sell those bedtime for Bonzo. He lives in Sweden, and he says they sell the Greek donuts there. He says there's about 10,000 calories per kilo.
Yes.
I said that's great. Try pouring good red wine on it. I wonder what you mean there. What would you pour on a moussaka? No. Okay. What are those grape leaves? What were they? Stuffed grape leaves. What's the Greek name for them?
Oh,
well, of course I want to know. Come over here. What's the Greek name? See, so you folks will know what I'm faced with trying to learn Greek. I've given up. I know about six words. So what's the name of these stuffed grape leaves in Greek?
Yaprakia.
Yeah, yaprakia.
They're the same as a stuffed pepper, only they're grape leaves.
Okay, we got to go. We got to get rid of our producer now because I think the congresswoman's on the line. Hello, you're on the Guy James Show.
Yes, hello, it's Congresswoman Allison Schwartz calling.
Well, good afternoon, Congresswoman. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Terrific. Good to have you back on the program today. You were in doing some votes this afternoon. What were you voting on today?
Well, actually, it was a food safety bill that we voted on that actually didn't get enough votes, so then we had to vote on it again, and a number of other, we call them suspension bills, so they're not as big as the issue of healthcare, which we were all swirling around talking about, trying to get done.
It's the issue of the day. Now, I am, help me here, talk me out of this. I'm very pessimistic right now about the healthcare bill. Where are we at? Where do you think we're going with it?
Well, I think this is one of those moments where I think it's understandable for you to be a little bit concerned about whether we're going to get this done, but I can tell you this to reassure you, and I think you probably want us to get health care reform done, is that we're going to get this done. We have to. The American people, American businesses, our economic competitiveness, and the right thing to do for our people really requires us to finally tackle this issue. And it is complicated. A lot of different pieces of this legislation affects every one of us in this country. What I can say, the best thing I can say is that it is absolutely right that you would want every member of Congress to be deeply engaged in understanding what we've done and to try and make it work. And so that's the moment we're in. We're going to see it through the third committee that needs to pass it in order to get it to the floor. And then we're going to go back home to our districts and talk to our constituents and look to September to vote on it and reconcile the differences with the Senate and get it done.
Well, I'm not pessimistic that we will get a bill. I'm pessimistic that we will get the bill that we need. And I'm worried. I'm starting to hear talk that pretty much from Max Baucus that any public option is pretty much off the table. We're starting to hear more and more about co-ops, which we are not excited about. I'm concerned that we're going to have yet another bill that our political representatives can come home and say, well, we passed a bill. Well, I know we can pass a bill, but we should be able to pass the bill that we want with the margins that we have, should we not?
Well, I do believe we have enough votes to pass this bill. There is certainly an effort to bring on board as many Democrats as possible and to really be able to hear all the different parts of the caucus, and we are certainly a broad group of people in the sense of, you know, the spectrum we bring and opinions we bring. Let me say this. I agree with you that this bill and the reform that we implement as a result has got to assure the American people that we are containing costs going forward, we are making the kind of reforms that means that people with insurance actually have meaningful insurance, and that we make insurance more affordable for American families. And that is, it's a lot of different moving parts, and I want to see a robust public option as one of the options. And I believe that a public option will be a part of the bill coming out of the House. As we define the public option, I want to make sure that it is fully functioning, can compete, and can help bring down costs and improve quality in the insurance that they provide and in the health care they provide. That's what I'm working on, and there will be a lot of details to be worked out even as this bill comes out of Energy and Commerce. We're not done yet. We're going to try, at least from my point of view, I'm going to tell you I'm part of the group that says we've got to do this right to the American people. I agree with you.
Well, I think you have to do it right. You know, I'm a Democrat, a lifelong yellow dog Democrat. I consider myself a liberal Democrat, and I think that you will. Let me just put it to you straight. I feel that we elected this administration on a couple of pillars, and this is one of them. And if this isn't done the way the constituency wants it done, I think that the Democrats are in huge trouble. Huge trouble. What do you think?
Well, I think it's very important for us to get health care reform done. I will say this, that what people, my constituents, others say, and it's hard to sort through all the rhetoric they hear. You know, there's no question about that. They hear some of the noise about, you know, what they think is going to happen or might not happen. But the American people say that they want to keep my insurance. I want it to be meaningful. I want to be able to have pre-existing condition exclusions done away with, and we're going to do that. That we're going to make sure that they have opportunity to buy insurance should they be unemployed or, you know, in between jobs. That, you know, if they're, they have to buy insurance as an individual, they're going to be able to go into a marketplace that makes it more affordable. We're going to continue a public-private system. Now, having said all of that, does that mean that everybody's going to be absolutely happy with where we sort of have to draw lines and how we do things? You know, probably not, but we are really trying to move this forward in a way that really meets that those dual goals of, you know, of making sure that people have access to meaningful health insurance. So if we can get, we're never going to get it right. I suppose exactly right. I suppose the president might even say that, you know, but we're not going away. Congress is here. We will certainly make further reforms. But I want to make sure that this bill is meaningful for American families and that it provides the kind of health coverage that we all deserve and the kind of health care we deserve. And at the end of the day, that Americans are healthier as a result of this. And those are pretty big goals. And I want to pay for this bill. I think that we have that responsibility to be fiscally responsible, not do what was done when we did a good thing, which was to extend prescription drug coverage to seniors, but didn't pay for it. $400 billion, you know, left to someone else to worry about later. That I don't think we should do. We have to pay for this bill. We have to do that in a fair way, too.
Well, I have a question from one of my listeners here, and you may find this one very interesting. And let me just read it to you. It came in by email. I am an expat living in Sweden since 1983. I'm now 55 years old and work as a medical translator. I've used the healthcare system here for several emergencies. Single-payer universal healthcare works wonderfully here. None of the things I've heard said about it from the Heritage Foundation and Rush, etc., are close to accurate and are gross distortions. The EU is very close to the U.S. in economic strength and ability to generate funds for social policies. What I want to know is whether Congress has had any fact-finding trips to the EU to study their health care programs, and if not, why? Scott from Stockholm.
Well, I guess what I would say is that we are looking, certainly, I think many of us who have been involved in health policy for many years have looked at what's been done in other countries, but we've also looked with the way healthcare is provided in different states. You know, one of the closer models is what's gone on in Massachusetts as they sought to extend health coverage to all of their residents. I hope that the comments that she's made are very reassuring to anyone who is concerned about the public option, but we are not moving to a government-controlled and a single government system of health care. We are going to do something uniquely American, and that's going to be a mix of private and public options for people. They're going to keep private insurance. That makes it maybe in some ways more complicated, but Germany, that has universal coverage, uses private insurers as the payers. So there are a number of different models, even within the European Union, in the way they provide coverage. But I think that Americans want choices, and they want, but they also want some assurances that they will be able to get coverage for their health services, and they don't always get that, that they won't have to be arguing with their insurance companies at the end of the day about coverage for services. So they want, and that they'll be able to buy insurance when they're on their own, if they're on their own. So it's really, that's the kind of guarantees that I believe that we can make as part of the action that we're taking, is those sort of guarantees. We're not going to go to a single-payer system, not through this piece of legislation.
Have there been any, to follow up on that question, have there been any fact-finding missions to the EU by members of Congress?
I can't speak to that exactly. I don't know what everybody else's travel schedule is. I can tell you that I have had an experience not as a member of Congress, but went to had the opportunity to go to France a number of years ago, and the intention was to study child care and the way they provide child care. But part of that was the way they provide health services for children and the women in prenatal care. And it was pretty interesting, and it really was informative to just know. I think the most impressive part of it was that you talked to parents who didn't worry about whether they would be able to get the health care for their children that they needed. And that kind of assurance, that kind of commitment that all everyone made to each other on behalf of each other's families was really quite impressive.
I live in South Florida, and we get many, many, many visitors from our good neighbors to the north from Canada. And I have an opportunity to talk to many of them every week. And they are, for the most part, I would say 90-some-odd percent happy with their health care system, and just are fascinated that we don't copy their system. In fact, I think it was designed by a gentleman by the name of Douglas, if I'm not mistaken, and yesterday or the day before, they voted him the most popular Canadian in history. So, you know, I don't know.
What I can tell you this, though, as well, is that I have I've both spoken to and traveled to visit a variety of different ways that we provide health coverage in this and health care in our own country, from big university settings that have improved the quality of care and the cost of care in Denver to more rural Pennsylvania, the Geisinger Health System, and the way they provide health services to a more rural population that they believe is more cost-effective and better quality and better outcomes for people in that area. So what we're trying to learn from is both the best way to pay for and the best way to deliver health care that improves access, improves quality of the services, and actually saves money for all of us. We certainly are using all of that information to inform us as we make some of these changes. You know, for example, I've been a very active advocate for making sure that we incentivize primary care. We don't have enough primary care physicians and nurses in this country. We don't pay them as much as we pay specialists. We don't encourage them or pay them to help coordinate care for their sick patients with chronic diseases. We don't really make it easy for patients just discharged from the hospital to be able to be back in touch with a nurse or a doctor to make sure that they don't have to be readmitted to the hospital because of care of a wound or compliance with medication or other kinds of treatment post-hospitalization. These are lessons we can learn that we know makes a very big difference in improving the quality of care, improving the outcome for patients, and saving all of us money. That's the kind of effort I've made. All of those kinds of improvements are in this legislation as well.
I want to know how anybody thinks that the private insurance companies are going to go along with anything that we do to try and save money. After all, they're in it for profit. You are not going to get them to cooperate in any way, shape, or form if we don't give them some competition with a public health care plan that actually competes against them. How in the world can we expect these fat cats that draw these monster salaries to cooperate in any way to save the American people? Because they've shown no inclination whatsoever to do that in their history. They've shown no inclination to do that. What makes anybody in Washington think that they're going to do it now?
Well, I can't speak for other folks, but I can speak for myself, and that is that I believe that there ought to be a strong, robust public option that creates competition and moves to these quality models and helps create the kind of competition that moves the insurance industry. I would not rely on the insurance industry to do this alone, and that is not what their incentive has been. I apologize, I need to leave to have a meeting with the speaker on health care. So we're going to keep moving this along, and I'm going to keep trying to see if we can get this right. It is a challenge and a balance, but, you know, I know, I hear the goals that you have in mind, and I hope that we can.
Congressman, thanks so much for being on.
We can accommodate everybody.
You got to get
all
this
right,
one
very
right.
Very good. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much. Anybody know how to dance? A little dancing there. That's what I'm hearing from everybody in Washington right now. Dance, dance, dance. And God damn it, I don't like it. They just won't come out and say it, will they? They just won't come out and say it. Oh, well. Hey, we're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, because of what we explained a little earlier, we're going to go to some audio that I think you will enjoy because of noise that's going to be around the studio here today, and we'll come back in just, well, very, very shortly. we're back here in the Guy James Show. I see we're going to have Sarah Palin as a radio show host. What the hell? You know, it makes you want to give up. Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin. Who's she going to... She's going to have a radio show host for seventh graders? Is that what she's going to do? That's all she's capable of. Oh, I tell you. I tell you. That just... I know. You can do what you want to do in this land of opportunity, but shouldn't you have something, some ability to be able to talk to people? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what the hell. You would just think that if somebody's going to do a radio show host, they would be able to talk about a few things. But evidently not. Trying to get this audio going, and it's not doing what I want it to do. Well, let's try this again here. Bear with me. We're about to have a lot of noise start next door.
Gentlemen, welcome to our general session. And I think one of the true highlights of the day, if not the highlight of the day, is to have with us Jonathan Alter, author of this wonderful new book, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. And I've been reading this book, and it has been like a gift of hope to read this book and become a part of those critical first months of the Roosevelt administration and the great tugs, the conditions that the country had fallen into, how close we were to so much that could have befallen us but did not. I also, before I had even known about the book, actually, I was up visiting a 95-year-old gentleman who was a great Roosevelt collector and scholar. And he said to me, that Alter book, you've got to get that Alter book. And I came back and I found it waiting for me. So I was I was delighted to plunge right into it and know that it's a great read. And I'm going to just provide a little bit of background for it, although it doesn't need it, but I just want to quote a few thoughts about it. This is the story of a political miracle, the perfect match of man and moment. Franklin Delano Roosevelt took office in March of 1933 as America touched bottom. Banks were closing everywhere. Millions of people lost everything. The Great Depression had caused a national breakdown. With the craft of a master storyteller, Jonathan Alter brings us closer than ever before.
I want to kind of start out by reciting a little bit of advice that Roosevelt would give to speakers when they had to talk in an event like this. He would say, be sincere, be brief, and be seated. I'm not going to take that advice today because we want to have a little time to talk and then answer your questions. But Roosevelt took his own advice on February 15th, 1933, and in doing so, he saved his own life and the life, I would argue, of the nation. Now, to explain how that happened, I have to back up a little bit. You know, I start the book by trying to explain where he got the confidence to pull off this rather astonishing conjuring act, what it was in his background that allowed him to do this, and his experience at Warm Springs, his relationship with his mother and his wife and his advisor, Louis Howe, and others. But despite his own confidence, the Democratic Party and the American people did not have confidence in Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. So anybody here who despairs of how can we ever find another leader like Franklin Roosevelt, if you had been Democratic primary voters in 1932, and they had a few primaries then, not many, I would bet that you would not have voted for Franklin Roosevelt. He was the governor of New York, but he was seen as a much inferior governor to Al Smith, and he was seen as a unprincipled flip-flopper. For instance, on Prohibition, he wasn't a damp, he wasn't a wet, and he wasn't a dry, he was a damp. He said, let's leave it up to the states. It was a way of getting some southern dry support. This enraged Al Smith. He was for the League of Nations before he was against the League of Nations. And this infuriated Eleanor because he was trying to curry favor with William Randolph Hearst, the powerful publisher, and so he kind of straddled on the League of Nations, which when FDR had run for vice president in 1920 had been his main issue, and now he's backing away from it for some good reasons because the League of Nations wasn't really working. He was barely nominated on the fourth ballot at the Chicago Democratic Convention in 1932. The New York delegation was controlled by Smith and the Democratic National Committee and opposed its own governor. Jim Farley, his Roosevelt's campaign manager, couldn't get a seat in the New York delegation. Can you imagine Karl Rove not being seated in the Texas delegation to one of Bush's conventions? And Eleanor was extremely unhappy about the prospect of FDR being nominated. In fact, her good friends, Marion Dickerson and Nancy Cook, went to Chicago with a letter that they had received from her in which she was threatening to run away with her bodyguard, Earl Miller, from Albany and basically blow up her husband's career. On election night when FDR won, she was crying. She did not want to pass cookies and serve tea and do all these traditional things that a first lady does, and it wasn't until the first 100 days that she realized she could be something different. So 1932, Eleanor's unhappy, Democratic Party is unhappy. Through a series of maneuvers that I explain in the book, he's barely nominated on the fourth ballot, but the mayor of Chicago, a guy named Anton Cermak, he stacked the galleries with unemployed men and paid them a little bit, given them some sandwiches, and when Roosevelt's nomination is announced, the galleries boo. So FDR sort of started to turn this around with a brilliant gesture where he flew to Chicago from Albany and accepted his nomination in person. That's when they announced the New Deal. Never been done before. It's hard for us to imagine, but until Roosevelt broke with silly tradition, as he put it, they would have what they called notification ceremonies where they'd show up in the hometown of the nominee like 6 weeks after the convention, and party elders would say, hey, by the way, the Republican Party, Democratic Party has nominated you for president. And he would go, oh, okay, I accept. And that's the way it was done for all of American history until 1932. And so Roosevelt flies to Chicago. It's very dramatic. This is only 5 years after Lindbergh. And he's greeted this tumultuous crowd. The delegates have stayed in session. And he's got a speech that Sam Rosenman wrote for him. Louis Howe, who's been in Chicago basically lying on the carpet in a hotel room for 4 or 5 days, hadn't left the hotel. He so disliked Rosenman that he stayed up all night, dictated a completely different draft, went out to the Chicago airport, handed it to Roosevelt and said, Franklin, this is your speech. And FDR said, hey, Louis, I'm the nominee, you know. But he looks at it out of respect for Howe, who's brilliant, instrumental in FDR becoming president. He looks at the speech on the way in. Howe is that they called him the medieval gnome, and he'd actually answer the phone, medieval gnome speaking. He had cards that were printed up that said, Colonel Lewis McHenry Simon Legree Rasputin Howe. So FDR looks at his speech, and nobody knows what he's going to do. No time to even go to the hotel to freshen up. Right to the Chicago Stadium, gives a speech announcing the New Deal for the first time, and he just taken the first three pages of Howe's speech, put them on top of Rosenman's speech, hadn't read it before together, and just did it. So it was very exciting, and I talked to some people in their 90s who were in the hall. So he started to turn the psychology around a little bit, but when he's elected, he wins in a landslide. It's an anti-Hoover vote. All the press says, this is not an endorsement of Franklin Roosevelt. It's just because Hoover has failed. So he's president-elect. And the rich are kind of unhappy about this, the fact that Roosevelt has won. And they start to pull some of their money out of banks. There's a banking crisis that develops in Michigan because of the crazy, totally dysfunctional relationship between Henry Ford and his son Edsel, who owned the biggest bank in Michigan. Henry wouldn't bail out his son. The Michigan system collapses. They closed all the banks in Michigan. Pretty soon, every day, another state is saying their banks have closed. People go, I've got my money in one of those banks. There's no bank insurance. I'm done. I'm wiped out. I went to Harvard or Yale or wherever. I was upper middle class, and now I have nothing. This is what was going on in the United States at this time. The economy is sinking between Roosevelt's election and his inauguration to the lowest point in the Depression. But they didn't know it was the bottom. So people thought maybe it could get worse. Nobody knew whether this was the end of capitalism, the end of democracy. There were a lot of people who wanted a different system. The word dictator had a positive connotation. Even Eleanor thought maybe we could use a benign dictator. Walter Lippmann, the dominant columnist at the time, when columnists had a little more stature than they do today, he went to FDR a couple of weeks before the inauguration. He said, Franklin, you may have to assume dictatorial powers. President of Columbia University said elections are not the best way to determine leadership in a society. Mussolini was very popular, not just in Italy, but in the United States. Extremely popular. So the economy is sinking. Hoover is flailing around. He and Roosevelt have these very tense meetings at the White House where Hoover can't stand Roosevelt, thinks he's a nincompoop, says, I have too much respect for myself to have my picture taken with him. Roosevelt doesn't want to get pulled in. And so how does he respond to this crisis? He hasn't picked his cabinet yet. He decides that he's going to go yachting. Goes off on Vincent Astor's yacht for a couple of weeks with his boon companions when the economy is crumbling. And he's the president-elect. He has to select his cabinet partly by radiogram in code with Howe and Raymond Moley, ship-to-shore radiogram. And he's out. Eleanor says, what do you want to go out with these guys for at this time? He knew what he was doing. He wanted a little R&R before taking over. So on board the ship, I found here in the library Vincent Astor's unpublished comments about this period and what they did on board the ship. This is the kind of thing that other historians have been totally uninterested in, right? Because there's so much to cover with Roosevelt that people haven't focused on this period that I'm talking about very much. And Roosevelt liked practical jokes. Later he even placed a presidential phony phone call as a practical joke on the press when he was president. He called up and disguised his voice and said, that he was representing a laxative company and asked NBC to give these reporters who thought they had nice singing voices a singing contract, and it was all a hoax. And that aboard the ship, his practical joke was that he had a little newspaper that he put together of headlines from on shore. The other passengers on the yacht, dozen or so, and he'd tell them what was going on in the real world. So he'd read the headlines that he'd gotten by radiogram, and he reads one that says, the United States Supreme Court yesterday ruled that all estranged couples must reconcile temporarily pending review of U.S. divorce laws. And there's a guy on board the ship who's just gone through a divorce, and he's blanching, and, you know, and Roosevelt said, I made it up. It's a joke. You know? So finally they land in Miami. The yachting trip is over. They motor by motorcade to Bayfront Park, Miami. And FDR is propped up in the back of a convertible. And he takes his own advice. He's sincere, he's brief, and he's seated. Talks about how he put on some extra pounds on the trip. He wants to lose weight, caught some nice fish. He's looking forward to being sworn in 2 weeks as president. Sits down. Saved his life. Giuseppe Zangara, an unemployed bricklayer from New Jersey, got off 5 shots from 25 feet away. Roosevelt now makes a smaller target. A tourist had thought Zangara was impolite to try to get to the front row, and he saved Roosevelt's life too. And a Miami housewife named Lillian Cross hit Zangara's arm so that his aim was a little off. And he ended up wounding 3 others and eventually killing Anton Cermak, that Chicago mayor who had been against Roosevelt at the convention. He was down in Miami because, to give you an indication of how bad things were in the United States, the Chicago teachers had not been paid for the entire 1932-33 school year. They were living by borrowing from loan sharks and family hand-to-mouth. They had occupied City Hall, almost rioted. Chicago was flat broke, couldn't meet payroll, and Chicago was not alone. Cermak wanted Roosevelt to maybe help him out. He approaches the car. He's shot. The Secret Service guns Roosevelt's car forward to get out of the park as quickly as possible. Roosevelt says, back up. The mayor's back there. Pick him. We need to pick him up. They back up. They think there might be other assailants. The crowd is surging. They start to move out of the car again. Roosevelt again says, back up. They pick up Cermak. He cradles him in his arms, the dying mayor, all the way to the hospital. There's a great story about what happens when they get to the hospital. Cermak's drinking buddy and PR guy, who was also a newspaper reporter from Chicago, came out and told the press that FDR had gone into Cermak's hospital room. He didn't die for another few weeks. And that Mayor Cermak had said to him, Governor, I'm glad it was me instead of you. And that's actually on a plaque that's in Bayfront Park to this day. Governor, I'm glad it was me instead of you. Never said it. So this newspaper reporter was asked years later, well, why did you make up that quote that went all around the world? And he said, well, what was I supposed to have Tony Cermak say? I wish it had been you instead of me? So I read many letters here in the library, dozens of letters that basically said the same thing from average people. God has spared you for a purpose, Mr. Roosevelt. You remember in 1981 when Ronald Reagan was shot shortly after coming to office, and his budget and tax proposals went sailing through Congress. I think a similar kind of thing happened with FDR in the 100 days, where this gave him, this incident, which has previously been a footnote, gave him, as a cell phone, I'm going to turn, oh, mine's off, good, gave him the some momentum going into the presidency. And it wasn't the only thing that powered his debut, but it was something that I decided to make more important than others who've written about this, who've treated it in a couple sentences. I sometimes think history is what doesn't happen as much as what does happen. If Roosevelt had been killed, and the bullet missed him just by an inch, John Nance Garner would have become president. Cactus Jack, the Texas Coolidge, he was called. And he considered that a compliment. He believed, he only gave one speech during the 32 campaign, and he said that the vice president should never, quote, do anything. He was basically a libertarian in many ways. He's the guy who said, the vice presidency isn't worth a bucket of warm spit. Actually, what he said was, vice presidency isn't worth a bucket of warm piss, and a reporter for a family newspaper changed piss to spit. When Garner found out he did that, he called the reporter a panty waste, you know. If Roosevelt had been killed, we'd be living in a very different country. I think Huey Long or somebody else would have come in. Roosevelt was approached by a reporter in the first 100 days after they had launched a lot of the initiatives of the 100 days. And the reporter said, Mr. President, if you succeed, you will be our greatest president. And if you fail, you'll be our worst president. And FDR said, no, if I fail, I'll be our last president. And I don't think he was being melodramatic in reading a lot about this period. This was kind of the last chance for democracy. If it had not met the challenge, as FDR said in his inaugural, he would assume wartime powers. And remember, during World War I, as Al Smith said, they put the Constitution on the shelf for the duration of the war and cracked down, abolished German classes and cracked down in many other ways. So people thought it was like a war. FDR himself was tempted, or we don't know whether he was tempted, but he was advised to at least consider assuming dictatorial powers. I found Director Cook made reference to this. I found in the library a document that was buried in what are called the speech files, and it was a draft of a radio address that FDR gave to the American Legion on his first day in office, March 5th, 1933. And in the draft, there's no name on it. We don't know if it was written by Louis Howe or Raymond Moley, or there were only a half a dozen aides who could have possibly written it because the White House staff was so small then. But he says, under my powers as Commander-in-Chief, I hereby reserve to myself the right to command you in any phase of the current situation. He's talking to 30-plus-year-old veterans of World War I who are in the American Legion, and he's saying, you're at my command. No reference to, this kind of concocted power that we've heard of a little more in recent years, inherent presidential power to, in this case, do what Mussolini was doing with great popular reception, create a private army, maybe to guard banks against these terrifying bank runs. Not clear what he was going to do with it. This Roosevelt did not give that speech, and he gave a totally unnewsworthy, unimportant five-minute radio address that basically just restated the only thing we have to fear, inaugural address from the day before. He didn't give the speech, and he passed word on Capitol Hill. Forget about Walter Lippmann and all this talk of dictatorship. What I do, I'm doing through Congress. And you can see in there all of the major pieces of legislation. They were not executive orders. They were not inherent presidential power. They were working with Congress, and sometimes Congress didn't rubber stamp what he wanted to do. For instance, he was wrong on some things. He didn't want deposit insurance. Congress insisted on it. He threatened to veto it, and he reluctantly signed the Glass-Steagall Act, which had deposit insurance. So he wasn't always right, but he had a great overall sense of direction. And I think that his leadership in the first 100 days, and really the elements of great leadership at any time, whether it's in business, the PTA, government, communication, vision, communication, execution. Vision, communication, execution. Now, the vision. There was no plan for the New Deal. As Raymond Moley said, to say that we had planned all of this is like saying that a boy's bedroom that's filled with broken baseball bats and old pennants and dirty clothes, that had all been put there intentionally by an interior decorator. So there was no plan, but there was a vision, and it was of a different social contract. And, you know, we all now argued, did President Bush respond quickly enough to Katrina? And nobody argues that it's not the president's job to respond when people are in trouble. But before the what I call the defining moment, this period in 1933, if you were starving, it was your problem. If you were drowning in a hurricane, it was your, in a flood, it was your problem. Now, maybe they could organize some voluntary efforts, but there was no sense of responsibility on the part of the government. We had a different arrangement between the government and the people. And so Roosevelt, during the course, began a few years earlier. It did come out of the progressive tradition with Theodore Roosevelt. But even there, they weren't focused very much on poverty in the progressive era. And the contract hadn't yet changed. It slowly did so. Some of it came out of some Catholic doctrine from Pope Leo, where he actually talks about a living wage in the late 19th century. And Ed Flynn, an important advisor to FDR, brought some of that to Roosevelt's attention. But it was a new, different vision of a nation where people were not, in FDR's words, subject to the winds of chance and the hurricanes of disaster, that government would be there for them in some fashion. And he started to articulate that and act on it from his first day in office, when he said to his people, I want 250,000 young unemployed men, hobos. I want them out working, doing conservation work, which he had fallen in love with here because he had planted a lot of trees in this area, by summer. And all of his cabinet said, cannot be done. Can't be done. He made it happen. It became the Civilian Conservation Corps, Roosevelt's Tree Army. They ended up planting 3 billion, with a B, trees. It's a lot of trees. And they saved the topography of the United States, as well as employing more than 3 million young men of all races. So the vision of a different society was there. The communication was stunning and revolutionary. Now, you all know about the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. It actually was nonsense. Americans had a lot more to fear than fear itself. They had to fear how you're going to put food on the table for your family the next day. You know, if you lived in Toledo, 80% unemployment. They don't know whether it's maybe going to 90%. Nationwide, 25%. You know, today, if we go up to, you know, 6 or 7%, it's a crisis, you know. 25%, and that was actually way understated because it didn't count women and, you know. So it was really much, much higher than that. So, but the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. It shows you the beginning of what they call in the world of fiction the willing suspension of disbelief. You've got to kind of cast a spell. And that's what he started to do to restore confidence at the beginning. People felt better after they listened to him. And the real breakthrough on that, I think, came 8 days later in the first fireside chat. In the meantime, he'd held the first modern presidential press conference. Before that, questions were in writing. That first week, holds a press conference. He held 2 a week. 2 a week. 998 press conferences. total access. Pretty different from what we have today. Fireside chat. He's looking out the window as they're taking down the scaffolding from the inauguration, and he sees a workman. He says, I'm going to write a radio speech that guy can understand about banking. Banks are closed. We're in a barter economy. The very first thing he did was close the rest of the banks. Most of them had already been closed, but he closed the rest so that they could figure out what to do. Nobody knew. So they come up with a banking rescue plan. It's quite conservative. He would kind of move left and right. He used the Herbert Hoover bank rescue plan that Hoover didn't have the guts to implement himself, but his people in the Treasury Department wanted to do. They came to him and said, you've got to nationalize the banks. The banks have destroyed us. And the backup position was post office banks. Can you imagine if every time you wanted to make a transaction, you had to go to the post office run by patronage? Roosevelt said, no, we're going to keep banking in private hands. But he knew he had to somehow begin to restore people's confidence in the banks. In this first fireside chat, two words began with, my friends. Those are revolutionary words. Not my subjects, you know. Before that, for thousands of years, since the beginning of government, leaders had spoken to their people like this. Some politicians, John Kerry maybe, still talk to their people as if the microphone hasn't been invented. You know. Well, Roosevelt did for speaking what Bing Crosby did for singing. He created a new relationship between the person who was speaking and the audience. And so on file here, you can see literally hundreds of letters that all said the same thing. I felt like you were sitting in my living room. They thought it was magic. They couldn't imagine this. Before, politicians had been shouting at them, and he was having a conversation with them. This is what, on television now, that's what they pay people the big bucks for, right? So that in TV and radio nowadays, if you can feel like you're familiar, that's what the money's for Katie Couric or, you know, Brian Williams, whoever. You sound like you know them. Roosevelt was the first. This was revolutionary in communications. And it had a revolutionary impact because after he explained how these banks were going to reopen, he said to the people, take your money out from under the mattress, which is where people's remaining money was, if they had any, and put it in these banks as they slowly reopen, the healthy ones they allowed to reopen. And the same people who had been elbowing each other out of the way in these terrifying bank runs to get their remaining money out of the banks 2 weeks earlier, the next day they line up to patriotically redeposit their money. That's leadership, if you can do that, if you can pull that off. But he also knew that talk was not enough. And so to vision and communication, there was execution. Smart ideas. He said to the hoarders, the people who were hoarding their gold, if you took gold out of the banks within the last month and you don't return it in the next 2 weeks, we're going to print your name in the newspaper. That got people's attention. And after he gets back from delivering the fireside chat, he says, I think it's time for some beer, a little liquid refreshment. And the next day, they pushed through Congress a bill to legalize beer. Now, if your kids are studying for the AP test, that's not in there. You know, it's all the alphabet soup of the AAA and CCC and NIRA and all these things. They're all important, but restoring people's, you know, spirits by giving them some beer was awfully important. By the end of the year, they had full repeal of prohibition. And then he starts this remarkable series of legislative accomplishments. And he understood that getting the bill passed was just the beginning, not the end of the process. So this is where Eleanor really comes in a very important way. She provided a tremendously important accountability mechanism for her husband. She would travel all over this country. And Lorena Hickok, her close friend, who she was developing a romantic relationship with, if you read the letters, whatever happened physically is a matter of disagreement, but a romantic relationship. But it was an extremely important relationship historically, because the two of them provided great accountability for what was going on in the New Deal. Lorena was a tremendously talented newspaper woman, and Eleanor was a tremendously talented social observer and reporter herself, really, natural reporter. And they would fill up Franklin's inbox and Harry Hopkins' inbox with what was working and not working in the New Deal. So they'd say, well, you know, the local administrator in St. Louis is not getting it done, and they would fix it. If you're going to govern successfully, if you're going to execute, you have to be able to fix problems. This is what's hurt us, I think, in the last few years, is failure to make those kind of mid-course corrections. If something wasn't working, FDR would bring in a new agency and, you know, get rid of the old one. He even wanted to get rid of the CCC. Congress thought it was working so well they wouldn't go along. He believed in pragmatism, in working these problems. One of the most important speeches he gave was during the 32 campaign. He went to on a picnic to near Warm Springs with a couple of reporters. And they said, you're not saying anything in your speech. You know, your speeches are platitudes. He said, well, can you do better? And one of them, a guy named Ernest Lindley, with the Herald Tribune, later of Newsweek, said, yeah, and he wrote a speech. Today I'd be fired for writing a speech for a politician. It's called for bold, persistent experimentation. Take one method and try it. If it fails, admit failure frankly and try another. But above all, try something. That was the watchword of the New Deal, bold, persistent experimentation. And Eleanor was instrumental in, she traveled down into coal mines, she covered thousands of miles, often traveling coach, and report back on which of these experiments were working and which were not. So in addition to, and she became much happier, and, you know, the Eleanor Roosevelt we know by carving out this new role for herself, write a newspaper column, hold her own press conferences, and came into her own. But it was, in terms of the execution of government, it was extremely important. And the net effect of all of this was that he restored the hope and faith of the American people without ending the Depression. The Depression did not end until World War II. So another 7 years. And yet he was overwhelmingly reelected in 1936. So at that time, the economy was bad, but Americans thought we were on the right track. Today, the economy is quite good. Americans think we're on the wrong track, overwhelmingly. Why? What's the difference? Leadership. People want a president who works the problems and is getting up every day trying to figure out, even if the solutions don't all work, how do we get there? So, to me, the experience at Warm Springs was a dress rehearsal for all of this. Because he broadened his own horizons, developed this great open-mindedness in part by meeting all these other polio victims in the 1920s who had suffered like he had, and he realized that they're hit with a twist of fate and they maybe can't afford to adjust to it as well as I can. And he connected with them, and he started to listen to them, and he tried all sorts of cures, an alphabet soup of cures for all of them. He called himself Old Doc Roosevelt. When you read about him applying for cures with the American Orthopedic Association, he sounds a little bit like almost like a quack in the 20s, you know? And yet, these people worshipped him to the end of their lives. Neither he nor most of them ever walked again, in the same way the American people didn't get out of the Depression until World War II. But his leadership was such that their hope and faith in the future was restored. So I think with that, I'll stop babbling, and I would love to take your questions, and thank you so much for coming.
I'm so, wasn't that wonderful? We could have listened to him for another half hour, but we will get to listen for a few more minutes with questions. Because this is being filmed on C-SPAN, I will ask you to wait until our head archivist, Bob Clark, brings you the microphone so that you can be heard, and then Jonathan will respond. And here's the water that you
great.
Had.
Thank you. Thank you. Roosevelt was considered the great campaigner. In fact, in 1936, he established a coalition that became the modern Democratic Party. What do you think that our current Democrats could learn from him and their mistakes? Because now they're the minority party in this country.
The question is about what current Democrats can learn from him, a lot, a real lot. But, you know, he got better as time went on. He was a political genius, not an intellectual. You know, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, second-rate intellect, first-rate, second-class intellect, first-class temperament. So that temperament is so important. And just to give you one little example from the 32 campaign, Al Smith was attacking him. Roosevelt had given a speech about the forgotten man. Important speech that we need to look out for what he called the forgotten man. And Al Smith, who was moving to the right, said this was class warfare. You hear that a lot now in the Republican Party when the Democrats want to talk about the forgotten man, the Republicans say is class warfare. That really started with Al Smith in 1932. And so the press came to Roosevelt and said, did you hear what Al Smith said about you on the radio last night? He was attacking you. It was actually much harsher attack than I've indicated. He basically, you know, threatened to take off the gloves with anybody who engaged in class warfare, and that anybody was FDR by his lights. And FDR's response was, he did? Oh, my radio must have been broken last night. Didn't hear that speech. And, you know, the ability to disarm with a quip, or he wasn't the wittiest man in the world. JFK, Churchill, they were probably, you know, funnier. But he just had this feeling. Churchill compared it to meeting him to opening a bottle of champagne. He just made you feel better after you listen to him. And that light touch is so important in politics. So I think you want to look for somebody who's kind of got some of that. And you want, most important, you want that suppleness and open-mindedness and that spirit of bold, persistent experimentation and inclusiveness. And you know, they said, Robert Sherwood said, if you told him there was a purple elephant flying around the Empire State Building, he'd say, let's go see, you know, let's go check it out. He was so open to new ideas and new experiences. And so you want that. And you want a good politician. You know, I don't think you can be a good president without being a good politician. So you're looking for those first-rate political skills matched with a vision and a sense of compassion. And it's not impossible to find. By the way, as I tried to indicate at the beginning, you know, people didn't see it in Roosevelt at the beginning. So one of these governors or who knows, somebody might have some of these qualities and grow and give us the kind of leadership that we deserve.
I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay.
Do you see anybody in the wings who is like that?
Well, you know, I'm just trying to get to know the presidential candidates right now. So yesterday, for instance, I met Governor Tom Vilsack of Iowa for the first time, and I got to spend some time talking to him. And I met with Governor Mark Warner of Virginia. It's way too early for me to say, well, you know, this person you know, has it. I mean, I do agree with what Charlie Peters said in an earlier panel when he talked to earlier today, that, you know, Barack Obama, in terms of natural political talent, he's the one right now who I'm most impressed with, just in terms of having it. Whether he runs or not, it's a whole different question.
How do you explain in every one of the elections that Roosevelt ran in, he never carried Dutchess County?
Yeah, how do I explain that he never carried Dutchess County? Because they considered him to be a traitor to his class. That was the line. That man in the White House, he was called. And so the thing that's so ironic about that is that, and what made Roosevelt a little annoyed, is that he had saved them in the period that I write about in 1933. Their money was in banks like everybody else's, the people in Dutchess County. And if he had nationalized the banks, or if he had somehow not been able to restore some minimum level of confidence so that the economy went up some, and if capitalism had collapsed, as even the head of the Harvard Business School said, you know, it might, those people would have been finished. So in later years, when they, a couple years later, when they're having at him, or in the 1936 election, when they're really opposed to him, he compared it to a lifeguard who rescues a drowning man in a silk hat. And 4 years later, the man he rescued comes back to the lifeguard and says, "Hey, where's my hat?" You know? So the ingratitude of the people of Dutchess County and other wealthy Americans almost boggles the mind, you know, their narrowness of vision. And actually, I think today's very wealthy Americans have a much broader vision than the wealthy of the 1920s and 1930s. It's interesting. If you look at people who earn more than $1 million a year, they are, you know, pretty evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. At a lower income level, at the sort of $100,000 level, they're heavily Republican. So the super rich in this country, the ones who, ironically, the Republicans want to, you know, eliminate the inheritance tax for, they're actually not overwhelmingly Republican the way they were in the 1930s.
If you look around this room, you'll see a lot of people in this room who probably had Roosevelt in their lives. That is, whose lives were somewhat shaped by the Roosevelt era. My question to you is, how do the Roosevelt lessons get transmitted to young people today, the majority of whom may not even have heard of him, or if they did, know him, as you said, as alphabet soup?
Well, that's a great question, and that's part of why I wrote the book, to try to, you know, convey to a younger generation. It's certainly true in my family. You know, my father was flew B-24s in World War II, and he remembers here when he heard Roosevelt had died. He was still flying. The war was in its last days, and coming back from a mission and crying into his oxygen mask. My mother actually took Eleanor Roosevelt around Mount Holyoke College in the late 1940s. And, you know, it was a very memorable experience for her. And that was kind of transmitted to me. One of the things that's been the most encouraging to me about my book, which, to be honest, is doing a lot better than I expected, because I neither did the publisher expect it to do as well as it's done, is that a lot of people are buying the book for their kids. And when I inscribe it to people, I often I'm asked to inscribe it to their kids. Some, you know, gave it for Father's Day or Mother's Day or something like that, but I've been more impressed by how many want their kids. So I do think there is an instinct on the part of Americans over 50 to say, let's convey that real leadership is still possible you don't have to give up on the system and the potential of individuals to change our country and to change all of us. Because as you said, you know, many people say, I grew up in a home that was saved by Franklin Roosevelt with one of the low interest loans. Or, I hear people come up to me and say, my father got a job in the WPA, and, you know, otherwise the family would have broken apart. So for a certain generation, he directly touched people's lives. I try to explain to some younger people some more indirect ways that maybe they haven't thought of. For instance, I say to some younger people, anybody here ski? You know, and they say, yeah, but people raise their hand, yeah, I ski. I say, well, you know, the Civilian Conservation Corps cut the first ski trails in the United States, so a paralyzed man was responsible for you enjoying your skiing, you know. And there are hundreds of examples like that, that if you think about them, you can explain to people that the bridge they drove over today, the tunnel they went through, was built under Franklin Roosevelt. And I think in conveying these stories to the next generation, it's sort of all of our responsibility to try to do that.
Given what you said about Eleanor, will her legacy make this country ready for a woman as president?
Will Eleanor's legacy make the country ready for a woman as president? I don't think so directly. I mean, clearly, Hillary Clinton was very influenced by Eleanor. You may remember that she even talked about communicating. There was that whole little flap about whether they were an astrology connection or they had a seance where they summoned her. Remember that whole thing? It was grossly overblown. But I think that Eleanor Roosevelt was the godmother of modern feminism, I think it's fair to say, and that, you know, she died in 1962, and the feminist movement sort of took off in the 10 years after her death, and I think that she was instrumental in giving a lot of women, including my own mother, you know, the confidence. My mother went into politics in Chicago, you know, the confidence to be pathbreakers. And in that sense, we do have a woman president, Eleanor will be indirectly responsible. I think America is ready for a woman president now, and I think America is ready for an African-American president. It's just a question of, you know, is Hillary Clinton the right one? You know, is Barack Obama the right one? You know, so it's not enough to say in the abstract that the country is ready or not ready. You have to have the right individual at the right time, which is partly serendipitous.
Mr. Alter, did your research give you any insight into how Roosevelt's disability might have affected his problem solving and his presidency, and to what extent was the country and the public generally aware that their president was wheelchair bound?
Those are great questions about Roosevelt's polio, and I devote a lot of attention to that in the book. On the first question, I think that getting polio, as I kind of indicated, gave him empathy. That he had some of it, but he got a lot more of it, particularly at Warm Springs. And you know, there's one picture of his shriveled legs, which is not here. And, I got some great free pictures from the Roosevelt Library that I've got in my book, but there are a few pictures that I had to pay quite a bit of money for to run in the book. But I wanted to run this picture of his shriveled legs. He's in a bathing suit. I'm sure he was embarrassed that the picture was taken, if he even knew it, to show how bad it was for him. He used a wheelchair every day of his life, but I believe, Bob, maybe you can correct me, I think there are only three photographs of him out of thousands and thousands here at the library of him in the wheelchair, and they weren't published until after his death. So Americans knew that he had polio, That was not a secret. And at the convention, they would say, you know, Governor Roosevelt is being helped to his feet. The March of Dimes on Roosevelt's birthday, they would raise money. It was known. A lot of times, people nowadays say, well, it was all a secret. It was not a secret. What was a secret was the extent of his disability. He didn't want to be seen in a wheelchair. It was almost at a subconscious level. He wanted people to think, if I've overcome my paralysis, maybe the country can overcome its economic paralysis. So even though he wasn't walking again, and it was a kind of a fake walk where he propelled himself forward, which he did by walking out here to the end of the road, first with crutches and then with sun on one arm gripping, another on a cane, and he kind of propelled his way forward. And the only tape of it is here at the library, 10 seconds shot in Poughkeepsie in late 1933. That's the only moving image we have of that slow walk. The country never saw that. Today, I think he would just go on Oprah. You know, he'd say, it's happened to me. And he'd handle it fine, but not in those days. And the press was willing to go along with it because it got so much access otherwise. And they didn't have any need to humiliate the president because the president was giving them so much news. Before FDR, the center of news was New York. Shifts to Washington. And so people say, well, nowadays, you know, the press, they were so easy that they were actually, they could be very tough. But on this issue, they weren't. Yeah.
Historians write about the Roosevelt Revolution. Do you think the press today has done enough in revealing the counter-revolution that has taken place?
The question is whether the press has done enough to reveal the counter-revolution that's taking place now. I think, first of all, I'm really leery of the idea of there being a kind of a monolithic press or media. It's made up of a lot of different news organizations doing a lot of different things. I think, generally speaking, after 9/11, because there was a sense of crisis, it was a little bit like in the first 100 days, and actually some people who lived through the banking crisis compared it to 9/11. Nobody died, but it affected many more people. And there was a sense of everybody pulling together. It included the press, kind of not reporting on some things that we should have. I think that ended quite a while ago. I think there's a lot of tough reporting that you see in the paper pretty much every day for the last few years. So I think it's a bit of a myth that the reason that you know about what you consider to be a counter-revolution is because you read about it in the press. You didn't get it from a blog, because what the blogs get, with all due respect to them, and I think they're great, I read them all the time, what they get comes from us, you know, and then they comment on it. But they're not.
Radical Life. Now all that's left is to see you tomorrow.